hour, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for August the 13th, 2017. Thank you for joining me as we take our weekly look at the politics and policies that shape our lives with the latest news from Chicago and Springfield all the way to Washington, D.C. Time to grab the Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee, and we'll try to get your week off to a good and informative start. Well, Dave, I'm glad you're in today because I know next Sunday you're going to be on a road trip.
At this time, next Sunday morning, we will be headed to Southern Illinois. Yes, sir.
Yeehaw.
Yeehaw.
And it's not a vacation trip.
No, this is a working trip because and I must say, very much excited to cover the eclipse, which will take place in the 1 o'clock hour a week from tomorrow. Around 1:20, actually. Carbondale, Illinois is in what they call the Path of Totality. That's the term.
That's scary.
The Path of Totality.
My freshman year there, I think I referred to it that way.
For a variety of reasons.
Exactly, yes.
But it is in the Path of Totality, which will start in Salem, Oregon, and stretch all the way to Charleston, South Carolina on Monday. This is really unprecedented for North America and the continental U.S., where, you know, really the continental U.S. will be affected in some way by this. It's going to get dark here Monday afternoon on the 21st. In fact, about 89% to 90% coverage for Chicago, but not as dark or as, you know, like the dead of night, which will take place during the solar eclipse for Carbondale, also areas around Paducah, Kentucky, and as it moves further southeast.
And how long will that last?
2.5 minutes.
2.5 minutes.
Yeah, it actually, the actual noticeable difference will begin around 11:30 Monday morning. It will start to get darker and darker and darker and darker. And then around 1:20, again, this is a week from tomorrow now, not tomorrow, a week from tomorrow, the Path of Totality will become dark for about 2.5 minutes, around 1:20 our time to around 1:22:30.
So for these reports, as you report from the Path of Totality, you have to, you know, gin up the voice a little bit and maybe, you know, have some ominous minor chord music playing in the background.
My thought was to recreate that you and I are old enough to remember the program The Outer Limits.
Yes, indeed.
We have control of your television
set.
Do not attempt to adjust the volume. I'll use the theme music from that.
Well, I noticed that Amtrak they're running a Eclipse Express.
Yes, the Amtrak Eclipse Express.
Sold out in 22 hours.
Yeah.
It's leaving
3 o'clock.
Three o'clock in the morning. Making one stop, I think, in Champaign.
I wonder if there will be a bar car.
Oh, man. Wow. Yeah, that would. I'm sure there'll be one on the way back.
Oh, definitely.
I think it's. I think it leaves at 5 o'clock on Monday afternoon.
At 5:15, uh-huh. Carbondale. But there are two stops: Chicago and Champaign. 5:05 in Champaign. And then hopefully if they're running on time, as you know, Rick, Amtrak can be a little late, right?
Well, but apparently they did, you know, talk to the freight railroads to gain clearance.
The operative word here, seriously, is express.
Right.
So they will leave, and they really have to, by 3 Chicago morning, 3 a.m. Chicago time, and then at Champaign at 5:05. The train will leave Carbondale at 5:15 p.m., 7:55 arriving in Champaign and 10:45 arriving in Chicago Monday night.
Boy, I wish they ran those express trains when I was there. That's a long ride. Well,
it is a long ride.
And I mean, it's a long drive for you.
That's why we're leaving Sunday, actually.
Yeah, because you might get there by Monday.
We might get there by Monday. And I have to be honest with you. That's my... My big concern here is the crush of people that are going to be down
right
there. Carbondale is really kind of the center of attention with this, at least for the Midwest.
It's nice. It's for something different than the normal goings on at the campus.
And you know the thing of it is, Rick, it's going to happen again in 7 years, because in 2024 there will be another total eclipse, and April of 2024 is Carbondale's in the path of totality again.
Really?
Yeah.
Only 7 years.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. So this is a very interesting turn of events with eclipses happening like this. The last time we've had something like this around the U.S. was 1979, but this path of totality that's affecting, you know, an entire swath of the U.S., this is pretty much unprecedented.
Well, and I know at the university they're allowing students in. They're doing some big event over at the Saluki's football stadium.
That's right. And NASA's going to be there. NASA is part of this. The Adler Planetarium will have events and doing various activities in connection with this.
Now, is Murfreesboro in the path of totality?
I can do a blow up of the map. We'll find out.
Well, I'm just thinking because, you know, you hang out at the 17th Street Barbecue and nosh on a little rib, some pulled pork, some brisket.
Well, there's an article about it in the Sunday edition of our Chicago Tribune.
And I didn't write it, believe it or not.
I was wondering if I would see a quote or two from you in there, but I didn't.
Andy, you ever had 17th Street Barbecue before?
I have not.
Oh, it's the go-to.
Well, that sauce is mighty good.
The sauce and don't forget the rub. Their magic dust, as they call it.
Yeah.
And it's some of the best barbecue you'll ever have in the world. Mike Mills found the place and has won. He won the big Memphis barbecue tournament. I mean, his daughter Amy is helping run things now, and she just came out with a book with some recipes and advice called Praise the Lard. it's fantastic. Schwanny, catch yourself there. But it's really good. And I'm going to the state fair next week, which, of course, I think anybody who knows me knows is just absolutely one of my favorite things in the world to do. He says,
I know what you're going to eat.
He says sarcastically.
I know what you're going
to
eat.
Well, but that's the thing is that's normally when I get a chance to see Mike. He's normally set up over by the Conservation World thing. And that's, frankly, that's where I stock up on the sauce and the magic dust. And it's like, what'd you do at the state fair? I got some magic dust. It's some of the best stuff you'll ever have. It's fantastic. I mean, that's the part I look forward to at the fair, is that part.
Not the hog calling contest.
There really isn't much. I'm sorry.
Or the husband calling
contest. I'm not trying to be a downer, and you know, if you go to the Illinois State Fair, go to the Illinois State Fair. But there are better state fairs. I'm sorry. it can get very and I just saw the kind of forecast for next week, in typical fair fashion, humidities are supposed to go up as our temperatures supposed to go up to be able to walk around the fairgrounds. Last year they had torrential rains and actually flooded out part of the fairgrounds and caused all kinds of havoc there. They had power outages, vendors had to throw out food because the refrigeration units lost power. I mean, it was you know, kind of like Illinois government in some ways.
Its own path of totality.
It was, yes, Illinois on a path of totality, yes. But no, so it's, well, there's the political days at the fair with Governor's Day on Wednesday. And then Democrat Day on Thursday, and the Democrats this year have decided that after they have their normal day-long brunch, literally, it seems like it goes all day, they won't be going back out to the fairgrounds and make all the same speeches that they make first thing in the morning on Thursday. So
there's going to be some sort of a... an appearance there, but it's
at the fairgrounds.
Yeah,
well, they're going to give people tickets if they want to go, but there's not going to be the traditional rallies and speeches.
Right.
And now the Republicans are going to have their rally and speech at the fairgrounds, and in fact, because of the renovations of the executive mansion, the director's lawn at the fairgrounds, the director's home, is actually where the governor has been staying while the mansion is under renovation. And I think he's told everybody about 1,000 times about how much he enjoys waking up to the smell of the goats in the goat barn now that now that he's living out there at the fairgrounds. But the fair is the fair. I suppose maybe part of it is when you've done it for how many decades, the allure of it kind of wears off a little bit. But I have had a chance to go to other state fairs around the Midwest. Iowa's is great.
You like Iowa's.
I truly like Wisconsin's, up in West Allis outside Milwaukee.
Orion has talked about it quite a bit and said it's a good fair. Yeah.
It's it's like everything else in Illinois. I mean, the buildings are have real problems in them, and you know, there's efforts to try to find funding to rebuild some of the infrastructure of the state fairgrounds, and it is great to see, you know, the animals and kind of get back to a little bit of the farming and agriculture roots of the state, and there's no doubt the fair excels at that. When you have the largest boar competition and you match that up against the Republican and Democrat days at the fair, I'm not sure there's a great deal of difference. How's that? I told you I was in this kind of mood this morning.
Yes, right. I might add, too, you look very dapper this morning.
Well, thank you.
You have an event of your own to attend.
Yes, this afternoon, the folks at Aurora University in their Town Square series, they have George Williams College at Aurora University up in Lake Geneva, and this afternoon at 4 o'clock I'll be hosting a discussion with former Transportation Secretary and Republican Congressman from Peoria, Ray LaHood. And the secretary has a book out, his memoirs of his life in politics and his truly career-long call for civility in politics. And I think, you know, as much as I kind of harp on that subject, it's a very apropos telling of his belief and desire for civility in politics coming from a guy who, you know, was inside Congress, who actually chaired the House for the impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton, and then went on to be a Republican in the cabinet of Barack Obama. So I'm very much looking forward to that conversation this afternoon with Ray. And yes, that actually meant I had to dress up a little bit today.
You know, that would be something that you could carry into the program at some point.
Absolutely.
Civility. And
and trust me, we will be very much addressing that subject, especially in light of recent events, which we'll also get into later this morning.
Yeah. Well,
Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy Mazur's in for Sam with all of the sports. Producer Casera's in for Jasmine to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. And our Twitter is @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is dreaming that I bring back a pork chop on a stick from the state fairgrounds. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com if you have to tune away. You can also find our podcast at iTunes by searching for Rick Pearson. the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Up ahead on our show today, after Dave gives us the 7:30 news update, we'll speak with Michael Golden. Michael's an author and educator. We'll talk about the national political scene, how our institutions of government have come under stress from the new Trump presidency, as well as, obviously, the recent events and rhetoric out of Charlotte, Virginia. Dave's back with a news update at 8, and then we'll talk to State Senator Andy Menar, a Democrat from Bunker Hill. The Senate's back in session in Springfield today, and Senator Menar is the Democratic leader of the effort to change the school aid funding formula, authoring the plan that Governor Rauner rewrote with a veto. And we'll talk to him about what's ahead today. We'll have more news and sports at 8:30, and then we'll be joined by Monique Garcia. Monique is my colleague on the Tribune's political team covering the State House. We'll talk about that school funding issue as well as the politics of 2018 that's so visible so far ahead of the election. That's coming up, but first it's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And yes, we'll start with yesterday's deadly violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, a rally of white supremacists, neo-Nazis, all to save a Confederate statue of Robert E. Lee turns violent. A car crashes into counter-demonstrators, killing one and injuring 19 others. Two Virginia state troopers die in a helicopter crash monitoring the situation. And then in response to that, we have President Trump.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides. It's been going on for a long time in our country. Not Donald Trump, not Barack Obama. It's been going on for a long, long time.
On many sides. On many sides. On what side? The side of white nationalism or anti-Semitism? What false equivalency can you create between Nazis and everybody else? On many sides. Serious questions being raised about the president's response to this. That was just a brief segment of his response. He went on to tout the unemployment numbers in the country as part of his response to what occurred in Charlottesville, Virginia. That was his response. You know, we are all Americans, and we see these great divisions that exist here, and we see divisions that, frankly, in this game of politics that we play today, divisions that get exploited to try to create support, to try to create a base. It's not about unity anymore. It's not about, quite frankly, civility. It's about trying to win, and there is no compromise. I just would like everybody to remember John F. Kennedy attributed this quote to Dante in saying, quote, "The hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in times of great moral crises, maintain their neutrality." Remember that quote. Also remember the president's quote, "On many sides."
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin on this beautiful Sunday morning in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower in downtown Chicago. A very nice day out there. And joining me here in studio is my good friend Michael Golden, author, social entrepreneur, public speaker, educator, and co-founder of the 1 Million Degree Scholarship Program. Michael, thank you for joining me this morning.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's the lack of attention span you should add to that last step. When I hear that.
No. Come on. You've worked on political campaigns. You covered political campaigns. We've all had to cover events that we weren't expecting we'd have to cover. Things like what happened in Charlottesville yesterday. And yes, it's appropriate for the president to address the country on something like this. But I think, as everybody has pointed out, except the White House, I'm not sure he really addressed the problem.
It's hard to watch. Set aside political party and partisanship for a minute, and you know, it provides hours and hours of talking heads screaming at each other and making the case back and forth on, you know, live national news, national cable news, as it were. But the thing is, you know, sometimes you hear in politics, that was a layup. He missed a layup. And for the few people who don't know that metaphor, it's a layup in basketball. Is you're so close to the basket, you just lay it off the glass or drop it in the bucket, and it's easy. It's a free 2 points. And that's what a lot of people thought the president missed yesterday, because how controversial, all things being equal, is it to call out white nationalism in a country with our troubled racial history? But then, and I'm sure you're, or perhaps, Rick, you're like me, when you take that out of it, the logic out of it, and you think about why would he not, it's quite something that an American, that the potential calculus for why he didn't call it out by name yesterday was this base electorate that he's always trying to
appeal to.
Yes, and that makes sense in a lot of ways because they elected him. But on something like this, it reminded me of the same thing when he was asked on national television during the campaign about David Duke. He lied about it. You knew he knew who David Duke was. You can go back into the history. And he was so uncomfortable disavowing David Duke because of whatever section of the electorate he calculated he was going to possibly lose in the primaries or the general election. And that's what it looked like yesterday, that he must know how wrong this is and how easy in this sense it is to be finally the hero for a moment, because you're the only president in this country that has that bully pulpit to say, this was despicable. It's not, you know, two sides. There's one side that's a white supremacist.
Well, and that's it. It's that issue of kind of false equivalency that exists there.
Exactly.
I mean, you're either with white nationalism or you're not.
It's hard to watch.
And, you know, you also have the fact that here is a president who's very quick to point out incidents of terrorism, international terrorism. This was an act of domestic terrorism. Republicans up and down the you know, who, you know, get called out by Democrats for not being strong enough in calling out the president. The Republicans yesterday did in their response to his response on this for failing to call out what it was.
Yeah, that's interesting. And there's been plenty of talk in recent months, actually, about institutions, our democratic institutions, and sort of the stress test they're under with this unusual, let's say, president in the context of recent modern presidential history. And I know you and I have emailed about that a bit, but this is another example of that. If I believe Marco Rubio from Florida, Cory Gardner from Colorado.
Cory Gardner, who's in charge of the Republican Senate campaigns.
Right. Now, this is, of course, this doesn't have to do with legislation or the court's rulings on matters of law. It has to do with, you know, the people speaking out. But still, the voice of congressional leaders is a very powerful thing, especially if it's one of the only elective national counterpoints to the president. So the fact that all these Republicans, look, the Republicans have sort of inched closer and closer to truly standing up to Trump, and now they really have in the last month or two in the Senate, the military leaders.
Well, let's talk about the Senate, for example. Sure. Is that we've, you know, seen after he had kind of the president gone after Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, and of course Sessions being a former member of the Senate, and so there's the collegiality that exists among the Republicans there, but then takes it up a step further and goes after Mitch McConnell. And to go after the Senate Republican leader, the guy who is going to have to move any legislation, he's a Republican, you're a Republican, he's your floor leader, basically, if you're president, and to go after him in that, as McConnell had said previously, you know, he's not of Washington, he's not of the understanding of the process, and the process is frustrating, that Republican, Democrat, they'll readily admit it. I mean, that's Unlock Congress is the lays out the whole story there, your book. But to go after Mitch McConnell, here again, we know it's an unconventional presidency, but having been saying that it's unconventional, how are you going to get anything done?
Yeah, you know, and by the way, if you listen to Paul Ryan for 2 minutes in the House Speaker will tell you how much they've passed through the House and it's sitting there in the Senate. And to a degree, that's true because a lot of things that we don't hear about all the time pass on in the House faster. And then
that's procedurally because of the 60 vote rule in the Senate.
Exactly. And you're right. And the House is just it's a lot more partisan. There's a lot less individuality in the House. I will be teaching students that again in a couple of weeks. But the thing is, the interesting thing about the whole McConnell-Trump thing, or when Trump is attacking other members of his own party in Congress, there's a little dance going on. He Kellyanne Conway, and he has pollsters. He has people telling him, hey, you're unpopular, or however they put it to make the king not
less popular. You're less popular.
And then in the next breath, they'll say, but congressional Republicans are 20 points below you. So what do you have to lose, really, by going out there and ripping these guys? Your base will love it because you're not the establishment. And, oh, by the way, do you really think that Mitch McConnell and these other guys are going to not pass stuff out of spite? They're in the same boat. They have to get reelected, too. Now, if it comes to an impeachment trial in the Senate, if the Democrats impeach and win back the House, then I don't know. You know, they're not going to. People are people, right? They're human. You're not going to go and stick your neck out for somebody who's abused you or tried to embarrass you publicly. But in terms of legislation, I don't know how much it hurts him. I mean, it hasn't worked so far anyway.
Right, and of course, you know, it used to be that it was trying to get Democrats to support something. It was like herding cats, and now on. Repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act, you're seeing it on the Republican side as well. And that, frankly, there is where some that individuality does show up.
Absolutely. And by the way, I think something that gets a little overlooked from a macro level, but about health care, that's really interesting. And in a way, it whether you like President Obama or not, he moved this entire debate. The debate used, you know, it now, if you look at polling, most people, and a lot of Republicans, too, think that people should have health care, whether you want to call it a right or, you know, the country should be involved or whatever. And the Republicans, I remember hearing repeal and replace a long time ago, that phrase, years ago, and thinking, oh, my, this is a brilliant phrase. It is short. It's alliterative. It's almost the same word twice. It's a great marketing slogan. Of course, I don't see how that would happen, but they're not thinking down the line. They have to get reelected. Well, the thing is, they knew that they couldn't, the House or Senate couldn't fully repeal it. I mean, that vote in the Senate was just to go back to the House and try to figure out
just
a plan.
To let's have a meeting.
Right. They didn't even pass that because they didn't trust the House to do that in a conference committee. This gets a little in the weeds, but the point is that the conversation now is, there was a poll out the other day that said most Americans want to fix Obamacare, including Republicans.
And everybody agrees it needs fixing.
Of course. The administration knew that when they passed it.
Correct.
I mean, you know, this is really, really hard. And I do understand. Look, I have friends who own businesses and have a lot of trouble paying insurance. And there are a lot of people that align with the former President Obama on a lot of things, but not on health care, because we all come from different places. We all have different insurance companies, different situations. And you can understand, in a way, wanting a more, you know, limited government. We have a long history in this country of tension between, you know, regulated capitalism and unfettered free marketplace. And that's what this is. But now the debate over 8 years, it has really moved into how do we make this work for more people?
Make that right of health care. How do you make that work?
Right.
Not just Obamacare, but just how do we make that right
and
to health care?
And improve the system for better health. That's not even really being addressed yet. It's mostly about insurance.
Right.
Yeah.
Not even treatment.
Wellness,
yes,
right.
Yes, exactly. We're speaking with Michael Golden. He's my good friend, author of Unlock Congress, and educator heading out to Arizona to resume his teaching. The Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio, joined by my good friend Michael Golden. We're talking about the politics of Washington and the new Trump administration. We were talking off air about the stress of institutions. We mentioned about just some of the stress going on within institutions like his own Republican Congress and Republican Senate. But you also look at things like the State Department and other agencies where jobs aren't being filled, appointments aren't being filled. I think there was a story just the other day about applicants to diplomatic corps have dropped by 25%, obviously leaning towards concern over how the president has treated kind of diplomacy versus his own brand of diplomacy. But, I mean, there is a stress test going on in Washington.
Yeah, there is, and so far, a lot of our institutions, though, have held up, including the courts, including on some issues, the House and the Senate. I mean, the I think that a lot of people, including myself, think that Republicans should stand up to Donald Trump far more so than. But you know, they have not been cowering, at least the last month or two. They've kind of stepped up to the plate a bit. And
as you pointed out, you know, you've got 2018 elections. Each one of them that's up is going to have to show something for it.
Right.
And how does that hurt the ultimate game of getting legislation approved? But at the same time, you know, you look at the fact that now a major Trump supporter is ponying up money and a super PAC to have a candidate against David Heller, who was against the
Dean Heller in Nevada.
Dean Heller in Nevada.
And Jeff Flake, too, in Arizona.
Right. And so you've got the president mounting primary, trying to primary Republicans, which runs counter to kind of the traditional game of Washington.
Yeah, it does. I don't know how successful that's going to be. I mean, there's a, you know, it could be a little bit of divide and conquer for the other party. I mean, running primaries, challenging, you know, you know better than anybody covering the, you've covered ones that I've been in, and they're rough, and they can do damage to candidates who are running. But, you know, going back to what you're talking about in the State Department, I think it's really interesting. You know, so much of what happens in government, most of us, even people like you and me who follow it closely, you can't follow everything. We don't know every day what's going on at the EPA. There's a lot of stuff going on right now that we don't see. And to your point about the State Department and them not filling these positions, whether it, you know, because people don't want to work or also because this whole, quote, deep state theory where they're trying to, the Trump administration and Bannon, these people have wanted to dismantle more of that government bureaucracy. In a way, though, Rick, it's, they're running an experiment. And by the way, they could be right. If some international crisis, although we've already, you know, had a couple that we're sitting here going right now. But, I mean, the ones that have traditionally required a lot of diplomacy from our country and all this infrastructure in the State Department or whatever department, we're going to find out if you know, there's a lot of people that are very worried that these departments' positions aren't filled and that there's not leadership. But sooner or later, we're going to find out if it matters.
Well, frankly, and you touched on Steve Bannon, and you know, even let's go back full circle to Charlottesville. You got Steve Bannon, who basically founded Breitbart, or not founded it, but took over Breitbart, and as a platform for the alt-right.
Took it to a whole new level.
And you've got Stephen Miller, who is, you know, being talked about as being the new communications director of the White House, and you have this core of nationalist figures in the White House. And I mean, my first reaction was I figured Bannon wrote the president's remarks yesterday.
I thought the same thing. Yes, right. And look, he's been around these guys, and Stephen Miller too. I mean, Stephen Miller comes from a long history with Jeff Sessions, and you know, there's this whole even cutting legal immigration, that is something that a number of conservative Republicans have wanted to do for a long time, and now it's actually being proposed. Like, these are some of these things that are being proposed, like them or hate them, they're very bold, some would say radical things that they're proposing. And, you know, I think you mentioned the midterms. I try not to make predictions anymore after being so wrong on November 8th, like most people I know. But I think what 2020, the presidential election, will swing on is mostly what it swung on in 2016. And that is those swing states, those areas, those 200 plus counties that went from voting twice for Barack Obama to Donald Trump, which is as far as you can move from one candidate to another. And I've heard, at least anecdotally and in the polls, a lot of them just, it's a cost benefit analysis, like most decisions in life. A lot of them thought he was a disgusting human being. They wanted a job the next day, and I don't begrudge them that. So the question to me is, look, he's not going to change. That's a cliche by now. The question to me is, in those states where 70,000 some votes swung the election, what does their economic picture look like? It's Carville from 26 years ago. It's the economy, stupid. That part doesn't change that much. You know, not the stock market. I mean wages, right. Jobs, real on-the-ground
employment,
economic security. Yes. And presidents have an impact on that. But sometimes, you know, the economy moves in waves, and we'll see. So it's sort of, you know, there's all kinds of conjecture all the time going on. Every day, can he get reelected? Watch the economy.
Well, and you're right about, and frankly, that's an experiment, because you talk about how during the campaign, obviously, we watched him talk about restoring coal mining jobs and manufacturing jobs. And we are seeing some forms of manufacturing jobs, you know, Foxconn coming to Wisconsin. But it's a different manufacturing era, too. This isn't the manufacturing jobs that were part of, you know, building that middle class.
Yeah, no, look, this is a question that I wish we had more time for, because I've written about it, and I don't think most people pay attention to it, and we certainly don't have the kind of policy debates or debates in actual political debates about this subject. But a lot of those areas in the Rust Belt and in coal country, and these jobs they're gone. The majority of them. And the question is, well, what are you going to do in this country to replace some of these industries or catalyze investment
and reemploy?
Right. And it's a very challenging problem. David Axelrod focuses on it a lot, but like when I write about it, it kind of lands with a thud because it's not that exciting. And in the debates, I would argue that the national journalists sort of failed the country in not asking enough about this, because it's a real problem. And it's also, I think, a big part of the cultural divide that's been growing in this country. If you're living in a rural area, you're not listening to people talk about institutions holding on WGN. I'm not making a broad sweeping generalization, but I know a lot of people, they just want the government to work for them.
But also get out of my, or just don't get in my face.
Well, right. That's where part of some of the hypocrisy comes in.
Right.
Keep your hands off my government health care. You know, it's
right.
But
before you take off, I wanted to congratulate you about the work on 1 Million Degrees. And I just had their 10th anniversary and raised $775,000. Explain what 1 Million Degrees is. You're a co-founder of that.
Oh, I really appreciate that. This is the best thing I've ever been involved in. And, yeah, 10 years. It's a community college scholarship program. But it's unique in that it's not just money that's provided to the students. Our students are incredibly hardworking young people, and some adults returning to community college. They just want a shot, but they have some unique challenges in some situations. So we provide coaching, and people can volunteer. They can go to 1milliondegrees.org. It's the best experience. People love it. It doesn't take a lot of time, and it makes the world a difference. We have coaching, tutoring, and academic advising, because navigating the community college system, especially if you're returning to school, is a challenging and can be, frankly, a scary thing, financial aid and all of that stuff. And I'm proud to say that, you know, 10 years ago we started with about 27 students. This fall, or right now, orientations are going on for 815 students, which is, and we'll have over 1,000 within a year. The mayor's office has partnered with us, the state government to the extent they've been able to, and chair of the Higher Education Appropriations Committee, Kelly Burke, has been great. So this program, and also our students graduate at two to three, about two and a half times the state average. And a lot of folks don't know, Rick, that 63% of students in college in the state of Illinois are in community college.
Right.
But traditionally, the graduation rates have been less than fantastic for a variety of reasons.
Sure.
And that's what 1 Million Degrees tries to address. So I appreciate you bringing it up. It's just a plain good thing. I haven't heard a single person in 10 years say, hey, that's not a good idea. What are you doing?
What's the website again?
1milliondegrees.org. And coaching doesn't take a lot of time. People come back and do it again and again because they get almost, in some cases, as much or more as our scholars do.
Makes you feel younger.
There's no question. So does teaching half the time.
Exactly. Michael Golden, thank you so much for joining me here in the studio this morning.
My pleasure. I love the spin.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning, and welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin on this bright and sunny Sunday morning here in August. Down at the Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. You have to love these temperatures for August, I'll tell you. And a lot of people still out, a lot of vacations wrapping up. Speaking of vacations, remember last week when I said that perhaps Washington might be looking for some vacation peace as the president began his vacation? Well, of course, we've seen what happens, and obviously all the news about Charlottesville, Virginia, but don't forget how this vacation started. The escalation of rhetoric involving North Korea and nuclear weapons.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before. Thank you.
Now, the president has actually probably answered more questions from the media on his vacation than he has in his presidency in the White House. So here was his response when asked about that fire and fury warning.
It's the first time they've heard it like they heard it. And frankly, the people that were questioning that statement, was it too tough? Maybe it wasn't tough enough. They've been doing this to our country for a long time, for many years. And it's about time that somebody stuck up for the people of this country and for the people of other countries. So if anything, maybe that statement wasn't tough enough. And we're backed by 100% by our military. We're backed by everybody.
And that's the president on the issues of North Korea. Well, we're going to switch gears now and talk about today's activity in Springfield. The Illinois Senate set to resume its session at 2 o'clock this afternoon over the contentious issue of school funding, of which we have none right now when it comes to general state aid. And joining me now on the phone is Democratic State Senator Andy Menar from Bunker Hill in Macoupin County. The state senator is the Democratic leader on the effort to rewrite the state's school aid funding formula, known as Senate Bill 1. It was his legislation that was rewritten by the governor using his veto. And the governor, yesterday afternoon, finally released the scoring of how school districts, district by district, would fare under his changes. And that's created some controversy of its own. Senator Menar, thank you for joining me here this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about today. Is there going to be an override vote today in the Senate to try to override the governor's changes?
I would suspect that there will be. I do know that yesterday there were many negotiations happening, many conversations, and I think that is further evidence that the Senate president and Democrats and champions of Senate Bill 1 would prefer a compromise route rather than a veto showdown. But as we've said now for several weeks, we are prepared to get this job done once and for all, one way or the other. So I would suspect, unless something changes dramatically between now and 2 p.m. when the Senate is scheduled to convene, I will file an override motion and the Senate will proceed.
So the scoring from the State Board of Education comes out. The governor's statement says that 97% of school districts would get more money this year, this school year, under the governor's rewrite than under the version that Democrats passed. And I guess maybe the critical term here is that it would be more money this year, because not reflected in those numbers is what happens in the future years, in the out years, as they're called.
Yeah, correct. That's one critical point that should be discussed, and I would suspect we're going to discuss that in detail today during the debate, depending on how this proceeds. But another point is that the governor's veto cuts immediately funding for 406,000 children in the state. That's a critical point. You know, we have learned, and you and I have discussed this on your show in past years, that any proposal that results in school districts losing money is impossible to get a majority of support on in the General Assembly. So,
right, because the fight's always been winners versus losers.
Correct, correct, and that's a fight that that I've learned lessons on. And this bill with the governor's changes, 103 changes, Rick, to Senate Bill 1 and the governor's veto, that creates a system of winners and losers immediately focused on Chicago public schools. And then in 2020, Governor Rauner's cliff becomes very, very problematic for, we think, about half of the school districts in the state, which would set them up for year after year worth of reductions. So I liken this to, you know, the governor handing the schools of the state, with the exception of Chicago public schools, handing everyone a can of Red Bull and, you know, giving them a rush of energy only to have a dramatic letdown 2 years down the road that will, again, put us right back on the path that we've been on now for 20 years, which is greater inequity, less achievement, results that don't match what taxpayers expect from public schools, and a system of winners and losers where the rich and the wealthy districts get more and the struggling, inadequately funded districts in the state get less. That's what the governor's veto sets up in 2020.
I want to talk about some of these changes, and I know it's hard when we talk about school funding not to go into the weeds, but I think we'll try to do it. But we'll do that. We're talking with State Senator Andy Menard, Democrat from Bunker Hill. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. I'm speaking to Democratic State Senator Andy Menard. We're talking about the issue of school funding. And, Senator, before we kind of perhaps venture into the weeds, a couple of questions about Chicago public schools, okay? Under the governor's changes, it appears from looking at their review, which I looked at yesterday, that this plan would spend $463 million less in state money to CPS compared to your version of the bill. And that's done by removing a couple of things, removing the traditional block grant they got for categorical funding like special ed, those kinds of things. It also comes from the fact that the governor stripped out pension payment money, wants to move it to the pension code. It's built into this bill. While he says he's supportive of that, there is no funding for it right now, so it doesn't exist. And those ultimately amount to the bulk of the changes there. But a couple of things, some callers saying, you know, well, the CPS problem started in 1995 when the city took over, you know, basically control. And when does CPS get held accountable for some of the financial problems?
Well, I've had that question posed to me many times over the past 4 years since we, you know, really started this most recent push to reform school funding in the state. Here's my answer. I can't, of course, vouch or take credit or deny any involvement in something that happened in the late 1990s. There are any number of things today that we could retrace the steps of history on, and we could point a finger of blame to some agreement or some piece of legislation that over the course of time relates to why we face such inequity today in the state when it comes to public school funding. So I know for sure that, you know, retracing those steps and pointing fingers of blame doesn't fix the problem today. But nonetheless, we have to acknowledge that school districts should be held accountable for the money that that they are given from the state and the money that they raise from local property taxes. Way down in the weeds, since we're going there, Rick, there's untalked about pieces of this bill. You know, this bill has been focused on Chicago and Chicago pensions, but that's just one very small piece of a comprehensive piece of legislation that was written by educators across the state, not by politicians, but by educators and by folks that do research on this topic. But we call for a new level of auditing and transparency on how money is spent that would enhance and strengthen laws that we have already today in place in the state. We think that's absolutely necessary. By the way, administrators, a lot of those administrators have expressed their frustration with that piece of the bill. But from my perspective, if we're going to devote additional resources, we want to make sure that taxpayers have every question answered. And the best way to do that is to be as transparent and forthright with data on how that money's being spent as possible. That's a piece of this bill. That's a very large piece of something I could point to that, again, came out of public hearings and public meetings and town hall meetings that we've had on school funding reform over the past several years in the state. That was a direct request and suggestion that I could point to on multiple occasions where I attended meetings with individuals who were seeking to help out this effort. So, you know, we ask for more transparency. We ask for more accountability in this bill. That's just one piece of the larger comprehensive approach that we take.
Well, and given that the goal here is of evidence-based kind of system, that's part of the evidence, is the accountability factor.
Absolutely. And for the first time, we cost out what the education, the successful education of a child would take in the state of Illinois. So taxpayers in a local school district can have a direct measurement, you know, kind of a direct litmus test of how school boards locally elected and, in the case of the city, how the city is spending money. And that goes all the way from CPS down to the smallest districts in downstate Illinois. Taxpayers will be able to compare what the evidence says is necessary and what is actually being spent. I think that gives taxpayers an incredible advocacy tool that they don't have today.
Obviously, as you noted, a lot of the attention on Chicago public school funding and given the city school's financial straits. But, you know, there are some who take a look at what the governor did in regards to various changes about property assessment and property wealth. And, you know, I'll dumb it down as best I can, but the fact that, you know, overwhelmingly the state relies on property taxes to fund its education. That's, for the most part, that's the biggest chunk of anybody's property tax bill is for their public schools, because the state has not lived up to what the Supreme Court determined to be a goal, that the state shall be the primary source of funding public education in the state of Illinois. That having been said, the governor makes changes affecting tax increment financing districts, of which Chicago has more than 100. But those tax increment financing districts exist throughout the state as an economic development tool. And the governor's changes say that the growth in property taxes in these TIF districts is captured by the municipality and supposed to roll back into economic development, school districts can't access that money. They can't tax it. But those school districts would take a hit as part of the funding formula. They'd take a hit on what they would get from the state because they can't access it. And along with that, then you have the property tax cap issue. Those property tax caps were imposed in 1991, primarily starting with the suburbs. Cook County got them in 94. They're in another, I believe, 28 counties throughout the state. That's done by the county and by voters. And property schools can't access the accelerate growth in property taxes because of property tax caps. And it seems like you have a governor who's been pushing property tax freeze, basically saying, well, I'm sorry, you're not going to get any state money because you didn't raise your property taxes for your schools.
Correct. And not only did they not raise their property taxes for schools, but the way the governor rewrites the formula, he pretends as if the law would allow it, even though the law doesn't. So that perhaps, I think, opens up the biggest critique that I have of the governor's amendatory veto. First of all, it's important to note that there hasn't been a single public hearing in state government on the effect of these two particular changes that the governor makes to the bill, the TIF change and the PTEL change that you just articulated. The governor vetoed the bill without having knowledge of the scope or the depth of what that would mean toward the larger goal of not just being the primary funder of public education in the state, but also what I think we all articulate, even the governor does, that we should have a system that's more equitably funded. Those data points were not released until last night in a rather unprecedented way on a Saturday night, the night before the Senate was to convene. The governor did the veto without having a single data point or a single public hearing on this vast change to school funding and public school funding finance in the state, which is quite stunning when you think about it. But, I think this is where the governor focuses all of his energy on the city of Chicago and using that as a wedge issue, which is a political construct, not one of public policy and public school funding. But just take Springfield, for example, the city that I have the privilege of representing in the state Senate. I believe Springfield has 12 TIF districts in the capital city. And this would impose what is undoubtedly trickery on District 186 in Springfield. The governor's veto would say to the school district, the state's going to view you as having access to tax that property that the state law prevents you from taxing, but we're going to count it anyway. This over time, especially in out years, because keep in mind, as property values grow, Rick, that burden, that change becomes heavier and gets us further away from equity as time goes on. That change alone will shut off state funding to public education over time. I don't know if that was the governor's intentions. It's hard to think at this point that it wasn't. But keep in mind, there hasn't been a single public hearing on that piece, but the governor did it anyway without one shred of evidence of what it would actually do.
Well, I think what raises that question about that focus on Chicago is the fact Chicago is the only are the only schools that are run by the city. And it's the city that creates these TIF districts. Every other school district outside of the city of Chicago is run by its school board and its and school administrators, separate from the city government, the municipal government that creates TIF districts. And so the governor says, well, creating TIF districts, there are consequences. But the school districts, for the most part, are normally, hamstrung by the fact that they can't tap into that growth in property wealth.
Correct. And I think, frankly, I don't know if the governor knows the difference. I don't know if he understands the difference that, for example, District 186, the Springfield public school system, is not the local government entity that manages, operates, creates the TIF districts within the city of Springfield. That's already a tenuous set of circumstances, as we know, across the state between local governments and school districts. The governor would inject this into the conversation, and it would directly pit municipal governments against school districts. And I think this change alone will result in lawsuits all over the state were it to be enacted. That's why it's important that I think that, we move forward with Senate Bill 1 the way that it was passed, that still has wide support across the state from all parts of Illinois, not just the city of Chicago and small downstate districts, but suburban districts throughout Cook and the Collar counties. The governor's changes are a complete rewrite. He described it as he's going to fix the bill. The governor completely rewrote the bill, and I believe the intention is over time, before the governor says, we're going to give you a shot of money, we're going to give you a quick shot of money, the intention over time starting in 2020 is to shut off the spigot of state investment to public schools, which will have the impact of burdening local property taxpayers more than they are already burdened today.
That's Democratic State Senator Andy Menar from Bunker Hill. Democratic Senator Andy Menar, who is in charge of the Senate Bill 1 bill, which could be coming up for an override in the Illinois Senate this afternoon. The Senate reconvenes at 2 o'clock. Thank you, Senator, for joining me.
You bet. Thank you.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. Governor Rauner gave his first national interview to Fox News on Friday afternoon. Brett Baer interviewed him in Chicago, and I thought it was refreshing for someone who's outside the local state government or Chicago media to see what it's like to have a sit-down interview with the governor. Now, he appeared for about 7 minutes. He was asked about immigration, sanctuary cities, the state budget impasse, school funding, and seeking a second term. And I thought I'd put together a quick compilation of his responses.
Our system is broken. The system is broken. Our immigration system is broken. Immigration in America is broken. We have a broken budget situation in Illinois. We have a broken system in Illinois. Completely broken. That's why our system's so broken. So much of our Affordable Health Care Act is broken. The insurance exchanges, boy, are they broken.
Okay. So, now, I want you all to remember, this is a governor who just recently shook up his staff and said he wanted to get his message out better. So, remember, there are two things that are true in political life. There's the message, and there's the messenger. Well, joining me now is someone who's familiar with hearing the term, the system is broken. It's my colleague down in the State House, Tribune State House Bureau reporter, Monique Garcia. Monique, I thought that'd be a great introductory for you.
Well, it's almost like a drinking game. Every time he says broken, do a shot. Make sure you have a driver willing to get you home, though.
I saw that. I also thought maybe it'd be apropos if we just tax that phrase, and that would get us all of, out of all of our financial straits here in Illinois. But the governor at 1:30 this afternoon in Springfield is supposed to address the media, no doubt to talk about how these numbers from the State Board of Education came out on his rewrite of Senate Bill 1 of State Senator Menar's bill. And you heard Senator Menar, he put out a statement as well, concerns about over 400,000 students in Illinois that districts wouldn't see more money under his bill. Plus, there's that concern, and we note it in today's story, which that's how we spend our Saturday nights here in, at the Tribune, is writing about the state school aid formula. But we noted in the story that one of the main concerns isn't the fact that in the first year there's more money for schools. It's what happens in these out years.
Right. So a major component of the governor's rewrite is to change how the money follows students. So currently, under the bill that was passed, it would be per pupil, which means that the dollars go to schools based on how many students they have. The governor, in about 2 years or so, wants to change that to per district, so that it's based
per pupil.
So per district, which means that basically, schools who lose enrollment over time, which CPS is one of them, would lose funding over time, and that creates problems for almost half of the districts in Illinois. And so there's real concern about what these numbers mean more long-term versus the actual immediate effect that would take place under his mandatory veto.
So that's one out-year change. You have the fact, too, that there were kind of is part of this evidence-based system, and it's very complex. I'm not going to sugarcoat it for anybody, and there's like 27 different factors that go into how much money school districts would get from the state for general state aid. One of those factors that had been in the original bill that's no longer there also deals with inflationary costs, you know, cost of living adjustments, and those aren't something that's held constant. The governor governor took that out of the bill.
Right. So there's not a lot of room for money to increase in these out years. And as Senator Menard said, it seems that a lot of his changes are aimed at taking money away from the public school system further down the road. He trumpets this now as an immediate, you know, look, we're putting all this extra money in. But a lot of his rewrite could have the opposite effect later down the road. And in his amendatory veto message, he said, look, you know, we have to try to control costs. We don't really know what the future holds in terms of how much money we put aside for education, but that causes a lot of concern for advocates who fought years and years and years for this legislation with the goal of making sure that Illinois does put more money into the system, not less.
Right, and plus the fact this whatever happens will be the first rewrite of the school aid formula in over two decades. And I don't think, frankly, there's anybody left in the legislature who was around except Speaker Madigan and maybe a few of his deputies that were there for the last time this was rewritten. And the goal is a long-term kind of blueprint for funding, not something that necessarily has to be tinkered with every time.
Right. The hope is that we wouldn't have to have this fight every year or every 2 years or every 5 years, that you put this legislation in place and it's a long-term fix. Obviously, you'd study that and make adjustments as needed, but the idea is to have to avoid these kind of overhauls, and that is why there's so much concern among Democrats and some Republicans about the breadth of the governor's changes, and that it seems to really throw out a lot of the goals that were stated in this process.
And I think that's why, you know, we obviously the initial fear was whether schools will open. We know schools will open. We had Comptroller Susana Mendoza released some categorical funding. That's the kind of special ed and transportation funding to districts to try to get them some money because the state, for the first time ever, didn't make a regular school aid payment on Thursday. That was the first payment of the school year. The state didn't make it because we're debating this whole issue of the fate of Senator Menard's bill that the governor rewrote. But even with that money, schools say they can open. The question becomes how long? And there's a lot of concern about, you know, do things drag out to the point that there becomes the, once again, political blame game of what happens if school districts are forced to close?
Right. A lot of districts who have been reaching out to the media or testifying at some hearings have said it's likely we'll get through part of the fall, but there's a real question what happens come October, particularly in some downstate smaller districts where they don't have reserves to tap into that some wealthier suburban districts might have. And, you know, that causes a whole other problem. You're having schools tap into their savings to try to stay afloat day to day. That causes issues long term for schools. Some might have to borrow, including CPS, which we know they're doing at a higher rate because
nearly credit card rates for their
right.
for their borrowing.
Right. And it's possible that, you know, programs get cut and kids go to school, but, you know, it's two teachers in a gym watching a couple hundred kids. You're not really educating students at that point. You're just making sure they have a place to go.
Now, with these numbers just having come in late yesterday, is that enough time, do you think? And I'm asking opinion, but I think that makes it very difficult for legislators to get a comprehensive analysis of what it means to their districts. And plus, you know, even though it's 1 year's worth of funding, you have the issue of administrators, for the most part, being highly supportive of the bill in its original version.
Right. I don't know. The answer is I don't know if this sways any minds, frankly. I think that people were pretty firm in their opposition or support of the governor's move to begin with. I think the details do influence some things here. But as you said, there was wide support among educators for the initial bill. And I think that when you have, you know, a handful of school districts who are big winners, but a lot of folks who are staying the same or losing a little bit, you know, that doesn't really change the conversation a whole lot for lawmakers. It's very clear the governor was trying to get these numbers out in advance of a vote to try to show the impact of his changes. But I don't know if that really the information was different enough than what people expected it to be to change how an override vote might go.
We're speaking to my Tribune colleague on the political team, Monique Garcia, who covers the State House for us at the Tribune. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, and on the phone is Monique Garcia, State House Bureau reporter for your Chicago Tribune. Figured it'd be a good idea to have her on the show as a way to make sure that she'll be wide awake for the happenings in Springfield when the Illinois Senate reconvenes at 2 o'clock this afternoon, poised to consider an override of Governor Rauner's changes to what's known as Senate Bill 1. That's the school aid funding bill. I thought it was interesting, and it's in our story in the Tribune today about the Republican counterpart to Democratic State Senator Andy Menar, Senator Jason Berrickman from Bloomington. And now this, obviously, we talked to him before the numbers came out yesterday, but when you interviewed him, he said that he found some of the changes that the governor had made in the bill went beyond what they had even expected, and that he considered the existing bill tainted.
Right. He said that there was a great expectation of what the governor was going to do. He went around for weeks saying largely that he was going to focus on CPS, but that ultimately his rewrite went far deeper than that. And you got into the weeds a little bit with Senator Menar earlier on some of those changes. And he said that caused a great pause for Republicans who weren't really briefed about these changes before they were announced to the world by the governor. And he said, you know, before the numbers came out, that without this analysis that we got late last night, there would be no support for the governor's amendatory veto. It's unclear if those numbers will change hearts overnight there, but he's saying that the best way to move forward now is to complete to start over. You know, take this framework that we had in terms of the evidence-based model and try to come to some kind of agreement separate and outside of this current bill, because it has been tainted by the politics of it all.
Well, and as you noted about going into the weeds with Senator Menar on this, and I mentioned about school districts that were located in counties that have property tax caps and the governor's push for a property tax freeze, and yet districts that didn't raise their property taxes or couldn't raise their property taxes because of the caps would be penalized in some of these future years in the amount of state aid to be part of the calculation of how much state aid they would get. And because they weren't taxing their local wealth high enough, they would be penalized for that. And now the governor calls that a subsidy that they get now. So it's subsidy versus penalty is kind of the name game going on here. But when you look at where those districts are, and as I pointed out in 1991, those property tax caps went effect in the collar counties. And here we got a 2018 election campaign fully underway. And you know, the rhetoric against Chicago by the governor is part of just the time-honored tradition of you go downstate and you beat up on Chicago. Everybody kind of understands that. But when you're talking about school districts and property taxes and the suburbs, the collar counties are a base of support he needs to get for re-election. And people hate property taxes, and the highest property taxes are being paid out in those collar counties for support of their schools.
Right. It seems in many ways that some of the governor's changes have the opposite effect of what he'd been pushing for, which is property tax relief for families. We have school districts and city officials who've warned that these changes could mean that they have to ask taxpayers for more down the road to make sure that their schools can operate at that same level. And so that has caused concern for Republicans who the governor wants to back his changes. There are some folks who said, you know, we can't do that right now. And that's the big question. You know, we're talking about the Senate today, but moving forward for a possible override in the House, and Democrats there, where they will need Republican support because of the way that the numbers break out in terms of votes, are trying to make that very clear to their Republican colleagues here, that there's some collateral damage here that goes beyond, you know, impacting Chicago, that this could really hurt some suburban districts. And hopefully the Democrats are hoping that that can influence some Republicans to once again break ranks and agree to override the governor on this veto.
Yeah, and of course, many of these suburban school districts, they're the ones who get the least amount, as it stands right now, the least amount of state funding, in many cases, you know, less than 10% of their funding comes from the state. And you set up a potential scenario under the rewrite of these suburban districts being penalized because they're not property taxing enough, and hurting that small share of state support, that state aid coming in. Real quickly, I wanted to ask you on the race for governor. We had J.B. Pritzker announce, he's the first candidate to announce a running mate, Democratic Rep. Juliana Stratton. She was elected just in the last election, won a primary over incumbent Ken Duncan. That was kind of a proxy fight between Bruce Rauner, who and his forces, who supported Ken Duncan because he had pulled off on some critical votes when Democrats needed them. Juliana Stratton, backed by the unions, comes in and wins. Do you think a running mate makes that much difference?
Well, perhaps. I think that it can hurt more than it can help.
That's what they always say.
So I think that, you know, he knows that she's pretty well vetted. She did have one of those very high profile races. So
$6 million for a primary race.
Right. So there aren't a whole lot of surprises when it comes to a candidate like Juliana Stratton. So and I think that it helps that that shows that she's willing to take on the governor. You know, J.B. Pritzker has been very clear that he's not necessarily looking towards the Democratic primary as his target here. He's got it locked and loaded on Governor Rauner, and he's saying that, you know, she fought and won against him once, and she can do it again.
And Pritzker, of course, last week having received the endorsement of the Cook County Democratic Organization as well. Monique Garcia, State House Bureau reporter from the Chicago Tribune, thanks so much. I know it's going to be a busy afternoon, and I'll be with you in spirit. How about that? Before I see you for the state fair this week.
Right, for corn dog.
Okay, you're on. Thanks, Monique.
Bye.